next session with 32510, Reel 2.
Going as Reel 2.
Well, eventually, I passed out at the Plymouth end. I came second, actually, in the on the course.
Can I ask you, what type of things were on that course? Because obviously...
Gunnery. It was purely gunnery, and it was quite simple from my point of view, because I hadn't long left school, and where trigonometry, laying the gun, was concerned, it wasn't referred to as trigonometry, of course, it was the clino and that sort of thing, but the theory was very simple, and I had no problems. I enjoyed it. We did night shoots and that sort of thing, and we generally trained pretty well there. And then we went for the last month to Llandudno, North Wales, where we carried on with the same sort of training, only it was more slanted towards the regimentation and the way that we would have to cope with forms and God knows what. Rather, although they kept some gunnery in, it was teaching you how to behave as a battery officer.
Is it also the kind of administration that goes with being an officer that you have to deal
you
with?
Have, there are certain things, lots of things you had to learn that you did or did not do. And all the time, of course, they were training us for life in the mess, but unobtrusively. It was just there. I mean, you were... Because you must remember, people came from all walks of life for commissions, and some of them would have been completely out of their depth, having dinner in the mess. But they weren't, because at the end of it, they somehow managed to get everybody knowing what to do. The loyal toast, gentleman the king, and all this sort of thing, it was all practiced there. So it was reasonably well done. And
what type of guns had you been training on when you were doing them?
6-inch, mainly. That was a standard gun in coast defence. It was at a reasonable range. I can't remember what the range was, but anyway, I went to and I passed the course 3 days before my 19th birthday. So there I was, with my white little bit on my hat, having to salute all my fellow officers with their prancing around with one pip on their shoulders. I'd had enough after about 2 hours, so I went to the MO and I explained my situation to him, and he's very kindly, First World War gentleman, very nice. He said, "Reynolds, I don't like the look of you. I think you're confined to billets for 3 days." So I didn't go out, I didn't have to salute, and I didn't have to do any duties either, which made them all a bit mad. And then, of course, my 19th birthday on a minute past midnight on the 10th of May, I suppose I was one of the youngest officers in the British Army. Just very briefly, and there may have been others 10th of May, 19, I don't know. But then I was immediately posted to Dover.
You mentioned that you, how life was prior to that. On your 19th birthday, did you celebrate your...
I had my first drink. I had never had a drink in my life until my 19th birthday. And then I didn't have all that much, but I realised I had a reasonable head for it, even then, very fortunately. Some people do, some people don't. It's in your metabolism, I believe. But anyway, I had no problems, and I duly arrived at Dover, which I can't remember the number of the battery, but it was on 12-pounders, situated on the end of Western Arm. There are two piers go out and one in the middle. Right, there's one in the middle which needs an entrance and an exit for the boats. Right? You get me? Well, Western Arm was the nearest point to France. And I was intrigued to find the guns were 1898, but the ammunition was 1902. Anyway, I fell into routine pretty easily. There, it was 8-hour shifts. And 3 officers doing the shifts and a major in charge, First World War, nice old boy. And I...
Did you have a command post?
We had a command post right behind the guns, which were too slow to engage E-boats, of course, far too slow. But the Messerschmitts used to come over for, we'd shoot the balloons down. And one went down, but it was still inflated, nearly, and it went down in the channel outside. And we got the order to engage it for target practice with high explosive ammunition. We engaged it, we hit it, and it went straight through, because of course it was so old it was perm solid shot. This was the first line of defence, Mark, against invasion. Again, I was out, we had trawlers that towed two very large trellis-like constructions representing the bow and the stern of the boat with a space in between. The drill was very simple. You took a signal with you. He would report the flash of the gun being fired. In this case, it was the guns further down the western arm, which were six-pounders. And then you would observe the fall of shot, and he would signal it back, plus 200, plus 100, minus 100, whatever it was. And as I was out there with him, duly doing this, and there was a splash, and I said, well, keep your eyes open. He said, there wasn't a shot, sir. I said, of course it was. There was another big splash shortly afterwards. I said, well, what are you doing? He said, there is no shot, sir. That's ours. Another one came from us. And I realised the Germans, with a Teutonic sense of humour, from Calais, were engaging our target. I immediately advised a trawler skipper, who with a lurid oath hacked the cable, left the contrivance out there and shot back into Dover Harbour. Yes, I think we had three or four shots from them, but because of course from our command post in up on the heights at Dover, where the big guns were, the cross channel, you could read the time on the Calais clock with your rangefinders. No trouble.
Did you have rangefinders, obviously, in your command post?
No, 12-pounders, no. You threw it at them, nearly. Dreadful guns. And, of course, you were limited because you couldn't fire in case you hit the people on the centre pier, which was another battery. And there was one occasion, and the Messerschmitts used to show off, and he used to come down and fly very low, straight through the gap, occasionally. And I saw one chap, we had Lewis guns, relics of Dunkirk left there, you know, pick up his Lewis gun and throw it at the Messerschmitt. There weren't plenty more down below, it didn't matter. But there was nothing you could do about it, because your guns were locked. You could not shoot across that space, and they knew it. That happened several times.
So essentially you were there again, really, for the coastal defence and any potential
pure
German invasion?
Coastal defence, yes. There were batteries on the eastern, western arm and on the centre, and then there was big stuff up on Lord Warden, up at the top, and Dover Castle.
Was Dover being shelled by the Germans
yes,
at this stage?
Yes, they shelled us. They hit the... There was a football pitch behind, up on the hill, and they were having a game of football, and they got a hit and casualties, I remember, on that. But if they shelled... If they dropped in the harbour, we immediately launched our little rowing boat and picked up the stunned fish to eat. Such is army life. But it was fairly rough there, because in the gales the sea used to hit the outside of the wall and spray went right over the top and onto the inside door. It was the only place that, except for one other occasion, when we ever issued with a rum ration. There was a 14-foot tide at Dover, and a trawler skipper came in, been minesweeping at high tide, came aboard and came up the mess and got thoroughly drunk, went back to his boat, and of course the tide had dropped. He just jumped lightly over and went down, broke a leg. Again, improved my vocabulary immensely. I learned quite a lot from that man. But by and large, Dover was a mixture of the occasional shelling, a little bit of bombing. It was a hard existence because we were on the piers and they were cold and everything was antiquated. But, I mean, it wasn't a bad existence, it was perfectly tolerable. But I eventually thought, well, this is stupid, this coast defence business is completely static.
Where had you been billeted in the town?
We lived on the pier, at the end of the pier. Oh, yes. It was pretty cramped, but yes, we lived there and spent your nights on duty gazing out into the black. Hoping to heaven you didn't hear an E-boat, because if it did, there's nothing you could do about it. Because the MTPs operated from Dover, you see, and they used to come back pretty battered sometimes, too.
Was it a busy port as well for other things?
Not much, no. It was too vulnerable. It was far too vulnerable for freight of any sort, really, I think. I don't remember ever seeing coasters or anything in there. It was purely naval.
Would there be coastal convoys, though, going around?
Oh, yeah, through the straits. Yes, the convoys used to go through the straits. And while I was down there, the Nijsenau and Scharnhorst went through. We engaged them from the big guns, but didn't have a hit, of course.
Could you see them from where you were?
No, we were too late. We were only just on the horizon. You could see the coast of France, the cliffs, but no, we weren't high enough up for that. But yes, they went. I remember seeing the swordfish trying to engage and shot out of string bags, shot out of the skies. God, biplanes. Yes, they were not, they were way out of date, but...
Had they flown over your...
They flew over Dover, yeah. But that was really all that happened. Dover was 90% boredom, as they say in the army, and 10% fear, danger, really. But if that, you know, maybe 95 and 5 for all I know. But when it did happen, there's nothing you do about it. I mean, it came from the other side, it was on the way.
Was there ever responses from the British guns firing on Calais that you would hear? Would they?
I don't think they did, no. I don't remember them ever. I remember them. They were practiced, but only into the channel, I think. I don't remember them engaging that far. There were 14-something inch guns, I think, 14.5 or something. They must have come from battleships. I don't know.
So how long were you there at Dover?
Well, I was there till I was looking at my records and I was so vague. Late spring, I applied for the airborne.
Was that 42?
Yes, in 42, I applied for the airborne because I first of all applied for the commandos. They very wisely turned me down. Originally, I applied to be a rear gunner in the Air Force, but of course they wouldn't take an officer for that job. So in desperation, I applied to the airborne, and I was accepted. And in about midsummer, I arrived at Bulford to join the 2nd Battalion South Staffordshire Regiment, the 80th of Foot, who were part of the 1st Air Landing Brigade. Four regular battalions who'd been 30 years in India had been turned into the Air Landing Brigade. Subsequently, two of them were detached to the 6th Airborne to form an Air Landing Brigade for them. But the Border Regiment and the South Staffordshire Regiment remained with the 1st Airborne. And because I was a gunner and therefore completely useless from their point of view as an infantryman, I was given the reconnaissance platoon. In which I sat rather German fashion in a sidecar, being taken around on this old Royal Enfield, heaven knows what, motorbike, a tremendous clatter. But it was something new, and I enjoyed learning the reconnaissance work.
What did that entail then?
You were probing all the time, probing and passing information back. It was pointless being caught because the information didn't go back. So they let you have a pretty free will about all over Salisbury Plain, and you had to meet up at certain references. I remember one map reference was a church, which I spent all night in on my own. That's an interesting experience too, because if nothing else, the pews creak all the time. But basically, we were equipped as an air landing brigade, with mostly infantry equipment adapted for carrying in gliders. For instance, the jeeps had no windscreens, because it was unnecessary, really. And we had The mortars in those days were attached to each rifle company. Subsequently, they formed a mortar platoons. But in those days, and so I was had nothing to do with mortars in those days. But I did learn about infantry weapons, because I had to do the weapon training course. And, of course, the drill, they march in three lines of ten for a platoon, or whatever your platoon was. And I, the first 3 days, the second day I was there, I was told I was leading the leading platoon, my platoon, on the Friday parade past the colonel, where we all went marching past, saluting him, to the tunes of Come Lasses and Lads, which is our regimental march. And I had no idea, having only ever been in threes, how to wheel 10 men. The sergeant major said, oh, the order's very simple, so son, hike up to two. So I said, mm-hmm. Off we went. We came up to the first, and I could see the cookhouses looming in front of me before I wheeled right to go past the colonel up there on my right, and I lost my presence of mind, and I could not remember what to say. So I said, mark time, and 1,500 men all closed up. It was incredible performance by Reynolds, and I heard the RSM rush past down by the colonel say, but I've told him, sir, I've told him. He said, no, no, pipe, 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 and off we went again. I had no idea what he said. And for the next week, there were four gunners being posted. We were, after the troops had been dismissed in the evening, we were on the square with the RSM. You are a dirty, scruffy little officer, sir. Attitude. But I eventually learned enough to get by. But it was a quite alarming experience. And well, I was so confused when I got the colonel. Instead of saying I was right, I said I was left. But they all, the platoon all knew where he was, so they all, and I knew where he was. But yeah, so it was not a happy parade for me.
But obviously, until that point, you hadn't really had the kind of traditional army training, had you?
None whatsoever. I mean, and not as an infantryman knows it, which is, it, I mean, it's always been different than the gunners. But it, I had no idea. When I joined that mess, there was a polo stick standing in one corner, and a big fan sort of thing, which a punker wallet would probably use. And I thought, well, this is a bit over the top. But it was typical of their attitude, first off. They had a number of officers who they got rid of and recruited from all over, and very good officers. And I, my time in the mess was better than university. I was with brain surgeon, who was our MO, barristers, all sorts of professional men, and they recruited some pretty good company commanders.
In many respects, at that stage, are you one of the kind of first wave of wartime commissioned officers going into sort of airborne forces, the commandos, that sort of groupings?
I think I must have been one of the earlier ones, because they were very wary, and their standards and the commandos and people like that were high, and they had enough regulars to draw on to fill their needs, I think. But the airborne was a rapidly expanding force, and was, I think, two parachute battalions, or maybe three parachute battalions, and one air landing brigade made up the airborne.
And with the air landing brigade, how does that differ from the paratroopers?
Well, you're carried in gliders to start with. That is, and we had awful casualties training on the original Hotspur gliders, which carried eight, towed by clapped-out Whitleys, no longer any use for bombing. And then, but we did graduate eventually to horses and the bigger stuff, and they became much safer.
When you'd arrived at Bulford, though, was it basically then you being kind of inducted into not only basic infantry drill, but also infantry training? Were you involved?
Oh, yes, I was in very much involved in infantry training. But I had to be, because you had to defend your position wherever you were. And we spent a lot of time on airfields, because we were being towed by aircraft all the time. During my time there, I volunteered and took a parachute course up at Tatton Park, Manchester, which is where I first discovered colour blindness, because the number one of the stick, we were doing a night jump, was colourblind and he jumped on the red, so half the stick landed in the lake. Lucky old Reynolds was in the second half of the stick and landed on the ground. But thereafter they introduced immediately this colour blindness test, which were, I mean, it was absolutely vital to that game, because if you jumped on the red, you were in trouble. But we also had trips abroad in Whitley's dropping leaflets in North France, because we were airborne and they were our tow pilots. Well, and I gave it to my friend in Holland, permission from signed by Brigadier Hicks, our brigadier, for me to go on a flight. And we flew from Netherhaven or one of those aerodromes. Because I remember flying out on this thing, they were clapped out, and but you pulled, if you, one chap walked down the plane, crawled down by mistake, clicked the lever, and they got all over Salisbury Plain, Vive de Gaulle, and all that sort of thing. But we dropped ours, and we came back, and I distinctly remember the chap saying, there's a barrage going up. Oh, the chap said, well, that's Portsmouth, which go to starboard. A bit later, there was another barrage. He said, the first one must have been Southampton. This is Portsmouth. I thought, this is navigation. But anyway, we landed back all right. But
with the parachuting, were you encouraged, although obviously you had an air landing role, were you encouraged to do a parachuting course?
They didn't discourage you at all. I think it was some slight encouragement to do it. Of course, the risk was you transfer to the paratroops. But the very first jump I did was from a 400-foot captive balloon. Four of you in the basket with two instructors, and you jump through a hole in the floor, because it was all statter chute. Your chute was attached either to the plane or wherever you're jumping from. You didn't have a free fall. And I was number two. There were only four of us. And at that moment, and the first chap was a sergeant for the Cameron Highlanders. And he jumped, and I was told to get ready. And I looked down, and I saw his chute hadn't opened. He got a Roman candle, as we called it. And as I jumped, he hit the ground. He was killed. And the instructors took us up again, and we did four more jumps before breakfast. The old pit theory, very wise. And then they finished by jumping not through the hole, but over the edge of the basket, show us how easy it was. And strange enough, I met one of those instructors years after the war outside the Café Royal, I think. He was commissionaire. Of course, he was a regular. But that was my parachute jumping experiences.
How did they instruct you in that? Do you do ground instruction prior to doing your jumps?
You learn how to land, roll first, and then you do... I seem to remember it was like an enormous crane gantry took you out. And you must have been lowered from that first off to give you the impression of something, to teach you how, because keep your knees and your feet close together, is the song. And I think that's how they must have taught us, but that was my first. I certainly hadn't jumped before then, so it must have been static training sort of thing. They did that first, and then took you up in the balloon, and you did one, or well, it's probably only one, I don't know, one or two, because we... And then you went on to the old Whitley's, which you jumped through a hole in the floor.
When you first jump through the balloon, what's the kind of feelings that you have when you first do that launch into space?
I wasn't the slightest bit worried, because this lack of imagination I've been telling you about, it governed all these things that I did. People said, well, it was very brave. It wasn't brave, it was just thick. Completely thick, that's all. I put it down to that quite a lot of the time, the things I did, because it never occurred to me what the possible outcome could be other than the one I thought it should be. And it was the same with parachute jumping, because we did night jumps, and they weren't very pleasant. Because the plane was roaring along, you sat down with your legs dangling over this hole, and when you jumped, there was always a slight risk that your parachute might get tangled up with the tailplane, and then, of course, you had a Roman candle, because you'd go. You had no control over whether you went or not. You didn't control the button or anything, you just went.
Was there a risk as well of, when you're exiting the plane, of banging your face or your arm?
No, you made sure that didn't happen. But of course, later they jumped out of the side of the Dakotas. And the parachute packing WAFs were paid sixpence a day extra. And I remember the sergeant volunteering to pick up any parachute, and come up and jump with it. Because, of course, they did get the old Roman candle, which wasn't necessarily the girl's fault. It might have been something else happened.
Were there any other casualties during the training that you were aware of, aside from that sergeant?
From the paratroops? No. No, it was perfectly normal, except for the lake mishap, which has nothing to do with the sergeant. But, no, it was perfectly normal, and after I'd done it, I subsequently cashed a few jumps off the paratroops on Salisbury Plain. And on one of them, I landed on a molehill. Now, you can't keep your knees and your feet close together when you do that, and I broke my ankle, small bones in the ankle, couple. I limped back to find the MO, Irishman, who was engaged with another officer in the pleasant pastime of putting their heads through the asbestos lining of the Nissen hut. See who can make the biggest hole. That I got a lot of. He said, report to me in the morning, take an aspirin. I reported in the morning, he repeated the dose, and it mended itself eventually, but it clicked for years afterwards.
So, did your ankle heal?
Oh, yes, but I mean, that was subsequent, that sort of accident. But going back to Bulford, where we were stationed, eventually, we moved to North Africa. This was all part of, obviously, the invasion of Europe from somewhere or other. We went out by boat on one of the big cruise boats, either a castle boat or something like that, I can't remember what it was. But we went out to within, sailed out to within 24 hours sailing distance of America, because the submarine's offering in the Bay of Biscay. And the Illustrious was with us, the aircraft carrier, and it was blowing a fair old high wind. And I remember the Swordfish planes, when she put on speed, couldn't catch her up. She had to tack into the wind for them to land. Anyway, we landed in North Africa.
Where had you landed?
Oran, I think it was.
Was this after the initial invasion and occupation of Algeria?
Yes, the First Army were battling away towards the Western Desert area, the Scots Guards and that lot. They were all out there, the Americans, umpteen Americans. No, we didn't get involved in any of that fighting because we were training to go by glider to Southern Europe somewhere, either Sardinia or wherever. There were a number of red herrings put around to fool the Germans, as you know. And we were going to fly in Wacko gliders, American gliders, made of canvas, I think aluminium, with plyboard floor. I think they carried about 14 or 15. Towed by American civilian pilots in uniform, except for a few hawsers which were going to take the very key people. But my platoon was disbanded and I wasn't wanted, so I was down at Perigo at the rail centre guarding the baggage. And suddenly a call came through, I was to rejoin the unit because this was 36 hours before they were taking off. Because there was an extra glider, and so I got hold of the sergeant and sent him out. I said, well, get them together. There was a relief on the way down. Where are they? He said, they're in the the village, sir, at one or two houses are known. I thought, So I said, well, go and get them. Very well, sir. I said, by the way, what's the attraction? He looked me straight in the eye, this man, he was a humorist. He said, I believe the big attraction is the one-armed negress, sir. He didn't bat an eyelid and then stalked off and collected them. He was a terrible man. But yes, we got back and I picked up my lot of about 10 or 12. I only knew my batman and the sergeant. The rest were all new to me, and it was a really mixed bunch. I had Lieutenant Colonel Walsh and his batman. He was a Royal Artillery observer. Great help. Two military policemen. My batman, the Brigadier's batman. A brain gunner from one of the rifle companies, thank heavens. And the rest were made up of odd bods. I don't know where they came from, but it was a magnificent fighting force. I mean, we could have taken on anybody. And I didn't even know their names, most of them. And it was this crew. And I had a 2 hours briefing. What was called Ladbroke, I think. The operation was some weird and wonderful name. Anyway, just before we took off, I was advised that what they thought were drainage ditches around Sicily.